You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, December 6, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Evan Bernstein. Up in the air. And we have two special guest rogues on this show. George Robb.
Kiwi.
Kiwi, Kiwi.
And Susie Wills.
Yay, Susie.
So as you could probably tell by now, we are in front of a live audience. This is a private recording we're doing while we are in Auckland, New Zealand. So welcome all the Kiwis. Susie and George, we're going to chat with you in a moment. But we're going to start the show, as we always do, with a This Day in Skepticism.
Yes. Normally I go a bit further into... Give me that look, Steve.
I'm giving you a look.
No, I don't.
No, he
like
does that.
That
face every time.
Every
you
time.
Do, you just never see it.
I just, yeah, I'm normally ignoring him. Or I'm in another state. Yeah.
When preferable. I give you a look, you'll know it.
why I oughta. normally, this day in skepticism is a bit older, but today I decided to go for a more recent item that we probably even covered on the show. So it's kind of like this day in The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. We probably talked about December 6, 2006, NASA images came back suggesting that there might be water still flowing on Mars. Do you guys remember talking about this?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we talked about it.
Wasn't it? Didn't they figure out what it was? Not liquid, it was ice, right?
No, in the final analysis, it does seem like water, when the conditions are right, it actually bubbles up through the surface. It can flow very briefly, but then it evaporates quickly because, you know, the atmosphere on Mars is only a hundredth that of Earth.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
I thought it was 1,000.
No, it's 100th. 1%. Yeah, 1% of an atmosphere. Still, you know, might as well be a vacuum as far as livability is concerned.
And we didn't find any water monsters, so... No. It's a bit of a disappointment.
So is the gravity on Earth, is it to our benefit because it helps maintain our atmosphere?
Yeah, it holds
our moisture.
Yeah, it certainly helps hold gases, right?
Yeah.
Just like Jay.
I don't hold my gas.
I know, I just wish you would.
Like, my ass is like Mars. I just, something comes to the surface and it just evaporates out.
It's not, the atmosphere though is not just a factor of gravity because Venus, similar to Earth, much denser atmosphere than we have. Mars, only a little bit lighter than Earth, and has a very wispy atmosphere.
Magnetosphere, is that?
It's the fact that we have a magnetic field, and that protects our atmosphere from the solar wind. Mars does not have a magnetic field, so the solar wind strips it away. It's also volcanism, so we are replenishing our atmosphere with volcanism, whereas Mars, the crust is completely solidified, because it is smaller, and so there's no active volcanoes on Mars.
Curious.
Yeah.
George, can you do me a favor?
Sure.
Can you rewrite the song Solar Wind for me instead of Summer Wind?
Ooh, no.
Solar Wind comes rushing in across the bay. No? You're not going to do
okay.
That?
Okay. Give me 4 minutes? What's the time?
I'm going to say now. Whenever you got time.
Wait, you are Weird George Yankovic, right?
Exactly, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Just making sure.
Yeah, you did write a song in 10 minutes in Australia.
No, I was like, that was like 30.
And it was like a wonderful, original, heartbreaking, original song.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Not a Weird Al Yankovic.
This guy, so we auctioned.
There was no solar wind, but it was, you know, right. It was okay.
Yeah.
We auctioned for someone to, George will write them a song on the spot. Took him 30 minutes, but that night.
Yeah.
And then he performed it like 32 minutes later.
Yeah.
And so what he's saying is you missed your deadline.
So what was the guy's story?
I had to give
it was
the
really
guy
cool.
Back. Yeah, no, so we had this auction and it got really like expensive and awesome and I was really flattered. And so I took we made that the first item at the auction. Like I said, can this please be first so I can have as much time as possible to write this thing? So we did that first. I grabbed, the guy's name was Dave, and we went out in the hallway and we just started talking. And I was like, where are you from? And he's like, oh, I'm from Sydney. I guess he lived in Sydney. And I said, what do you do? And he's like, I'm an anesthetist. I'm like, what rhymes with anesthetist? I'm like, oh my God. And I noticed he had an accent that wasn't Australian. And I said, where are you from originally? And he says, Poland. And I'm like, oh, okay. So what's the deal with, like, how'd you come to Australia? He said, well, my family had to secretly escape from Poland in 1985. We took a trip to Italy and then we basically just like ran away to this, to the Italian consulate and like took refuge there and left everything behind. And I'm like, that's the song. So I wrote this. He just said, yeah, we had to leave with no warning. And I was like, no warning. That's the title. I said, all right, go away. And he went away and I went over the corner and then just wrote this little song about a family leaving in the middle of the night with no warning and leaving everything behind. His dad was a carpenter. His mom was like a travel booking agent or something like that. So I just like used a little bit of wood metaphor and, you know, working on thing. And yeah, it was
boom. It came out very cool. Really,
that was
really
fun.
Was what
fun.
Did you end up rhyming anesthetist with? I don't remember.
The best with this.
Yes. Okay. That's right. That's what it is. Yeah. No, I
okay. Bob, so just a playing off of the This Day in Skepticism, the whole bit about water on Mars, there's a bit of an update with that.
So this is definitely related to what Rebecca was talking about. A new study from scientists is kind of pointing to the idea that the idea of Mars being wet happened in the past, but only over very, you know, repeated events caused by volcanism. So it's not something that happened for a long time. It just happened kind of intermittently. Which is kind of a brand new idea. Because when we think of Mars, and ancient Mars anyway, we think that there's water flowing everywhere. It might have even been tropical. But now they're thinking that maybe that wasn't the case. Because if you look at the period in time in Mars when water was flowing about 3.7 billion years ago, the atmosphere was crazy thin. I mean, yeah, I think it was even thinner than maybe even now. But either way, it was very thin and it was very cold. And also the sun back then, what do you think what was the sun like, say, 3.7 billion years ago? How would you think it would be different? A younger sun.
Was it a little bit brighter?
No, it was actually 25% dimmer. So there's less solar radiation.
Why?
Hitting. That's just the evolution of a star. It gets brighter. Brighter and bigger even now, Jay. So in, I think, a few hundred million years, it's going to be almost unlivable on the planet, unless you're bacteria. So yeah, that's just how it progresses. So if you look at Mars 3.7 billion years, it was really cold, the atmosphere was really thin, and the sun was dimmer, and, oh, this one was really cool. They ran some atmospheric models of Mars, and they found that there was not one place on Mars that could have had liquid water. So none of that really makes any sense. How could there be water on Mars if all those factors were coming into play? One possibility that they came up with when they ran these simulations with that was that, if the axis of Mars was shifted 40 degrees, it's possible that it could have been hot enough for parts of Mars to have water. But when they calculated where the wet place would be, it wasn't where we see all the, you know, the ancient lake beds and any of that stuff. So that didn't make any sense.
Do those lake beds, those have to be water-based? All those rivers and all those?
We are so familiar with that, those kinds of geological structures on the Earth, it's pretty clear to geologists that this is flowing water or flowing something.
What else could it be? Could it be methane or could it be like some kind of a something
it's
else?
Blood, perhaps?
It's not,
blood.
It's not,
not
quite,
cold enough for
it's
methane.
It's not cold enough for methane to flow.
Blood's thicker than water, Rebecca.
Chances are it was...
So it's got to be water.
It's got to be water.
Okay. So the question then is, what is the mechanism? How do you explain evidence of water on a planet where, back at that time, water couldn't have existed?
But I'm confused about the whole premise because I thought that Mars had a lot of water and it evaporated off.
Well, there's no question there was flowing water on ancient Mars because we see ancient riverbeds and lake beds.
Yeah, there's
geological formations that we know from looking at the Earth 100% was formed by flowing water.
Right. So what the scientists at Brown University and the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel, what they're saying is that the mechanism to allow this to happen is volcanoes. If you look at the history of Mars, at that time, about 3.7 billion years ago, when all this water was really flowing, there was incredible volcanic activity going on. So they thought that maybe that was related somehow. But the thing is, when you think of volcanoes on the Earth, what do you think? You have ash being spewed into the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. It blocks light and things get colder. So how does that make Mars warmer? It doesn't seem to make sense, right? So they ran simulations again. Thank God for simulations. And they discovered that the sulfuric acid particles from the volcanoes would interact with the dust on Mars. That actually, I'm not sure how that mechanism would work, but it actually lets the light, it's less reflective, so the light gets, you know, deeper into the atmosphere and can warm up the planet. because of the interaction between these compounds. And also, it's possible that sulfur dioxide could have been spewed out in great quantities, and that would cause a greenhouse effect. So they think that's kind of what happened. But that's not even the fascinating part, because they think that if this happened the way they think it did, it only happened episodically. We would have, you'd have volcanic eruptions, and then for either 10 years to 100 years, just a century, water would flow, and then it would go away. Then there'd be no more water. The water would be gone. And then, after many centuries or millennia, you'd have another volcanic eruption, more water. So this happened for 200 million years. That's a long time, but it's, even though it was episodic, you could still have enough water flowing to account for what we observed. So it kind of all makes sense.
Planet-wide volcanic things, or like one huge volcano?
Primarily in specific areas where all this volcanic activity happened, which also happens to be where a lot of this evidence happens. Now, this isn't ironclad. This isn't like a done deal, and we're ready to move on. It's still preliminary, so keep that in mind. One guy said a quote. James Bell is a planetary geologist. He said that they make a reasonable argument that's consistent with a lot of the data, but there's still a lot of other data that's not consistent with the idea of water's limited presence on the planet. So it's not a done deal with that. So the implication that really strikes me about this is life. What's the implication for life on Mars? If you've got an episodic kind of life, can life really start? Even, if you have water flowing for 100 years, Steve, what could really happen in 100 years?
Unless there was a period or a condition somewhere else on Mars where life could evolve and then adapt to that kind of situation.
Right. One scientist was comparing this to algal mats in Antarctica, because they can go through extremely cold and dry times where they're just kind of like quiescent, and they're not like suspended animation. But that has to evolve already. That assumes that something's already evolved. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's some subsurface water that was persistent that allowed life to evolve, and just the surface was episodic.
Right.
Or maybe panspermia. Maybe life came from the Earth and landed and got life going. So interesting, though. So we'll see how that pans out.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like overall it would be a negative thing for the prospect of life
on
Mars.
Yeah.
If you only have these brief spurts of water rather than there was millions of years of continuous lakes and rivers on Mars.
Right.
So
Mars is just not hospitable. It's just not a good place for us. I'd rather us make a base on the moon than to waste our time going to Mars.
Well, that's the practical next step to getting to Mars is really getting to the moon first.
Moon base alpha.
And then you think about Mars after that.
And this news, though, isn't particularly about us and our ability to like terraform Mars or make it habitable for humans. I think, isn't it more just about what life could have been before, right? Yeah, regardless, like we could still set up a base on Mars. Like this doesn't really change that, I don't think, right? Or does it say like maybe a volcano will blow us up?
No. It doesn't impact the possibility of that happening for sure.
Just the probability of finding life hiding away somewhere on Mars.
Not as good as we
thought. Maybe.
If this is correct.
It's hard to say. Well, Susie, this is your second time on the show.
Yes. Thank you for having me.
The first time we were talking about the conference that we're at right now.
And now you're here.
You're here. Now we're here.
In our city of volcanoes. That's kind of appropriate, really.
We've smelled it. Yeah. So we know about what ancient Mars smelled like. It smelled like Rotorua.
Yep.
Yeah.
We were at a hotel in Rotorua, and multiple times I would walk outside, and then I would look around for Jay, like, Jay, what the hell? And then somebody would say, we're in Rotorua. I'm like, oh, of course we are. That explains it. Yeah. Right, Jay?
I did wake up one of the nights we were there. I woke up, and I'm like, oh, I just blew the hotel room out.
Blew the town out.
And then my brother-in-law was like, no, there is like a volcano like around here. That's actually like shit that comes from hell. He realized it.
Brimstone, I loved it.
So tell us some more about, when we all got here, you took our picture illuminated by bacteria. Tell us about that.
So I'm a microbiologist, but fascinated by creatures that glow in the dark. And so actually for my research, I take the genes from various creatures like glowing bacteria and put them into really nasty bacteria. But I like to have some glowing bacteria that aren't nasty to kind of show people some of the concepts that we work with, but then also to take these amazing pictures. So I have this cube kind of pop up, and I make people sit inside it in the dark, and then have petri dishes that have these glowing bacteria on them. And the idea is that the only light that's reaching the camera is coming from the bacteria. So I take these amazing pictures, and maybe we'll put them up on Flickr somewhere, where people are just this beautiful kind of bluey green glow, which is the color that the bacteria are glowing. So yeah, it's really cool. Like, you came up just so awesome with your hair. It was just basically anything that's
It was great, Steve. Yeah, it was awesome. You looked so good with your hair, Steve.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
for really our listeners, and fantastic.
For both our listeners, Susie is pointing at me.
I mean, the corona on George's head, though, was
that,
awesome.
Yeah.
It's really impressive.
That's what I'm going for, the corona.
Yeah.
What chemical causes that color, that blue-green glow?
So that is a bacteria that's producing a light using a chemical reaction. So we call the chemicals luciferin and luciferase, but actually we know of about 5 different luciferin luciferase pairs. So the ones, so they're all kind of chemically different. So it's the same reaction that fireflies use to glow, but slightly different chemicals. And the color of the light's kind of dependent on the luciferase. Mm-hmm. So, and this is the color of light that travels best through water. So this is a bacteria that I isolated from some fish that I bought in the supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
Because being in New Zealand, it had to be something native, and not dangerous, so I could take it out and do things like this at schools and stuff. And so it's this beautiful, I love it. I spend so much time in the dark.
Fish? You bought fish at the supermarket and you had glowing bacteria.
Okay, do you want me to tell you the story? Because they're very cool. So, this is a bacteria called Photobacterium. And the reason it glows is because it wants to be inside of the guts of fish, because that is a really awesome place if you're a bacteria, because it's so full of nutrients. So what some scientists discovered quite recently, actually, is that what happens is this bacteria is kind of floating around in the sea, and it gets swallowed by zooplankton. And then the zooplankton realize they can't actually eat it. So now you've got this little zooplankton floating around glowing in the dark. And it just so happens that this makes them visible to fish. So they've done some experiments in labs where they've had these little zooplankton, and you put them in a tank with some fish, and hey, they get swallowed by the fish. So what happens is these poor little zooplankton who are now glowing get eaten by the fish, then digested, and the bacteria survive this passage into the gut, and they get released into the fish's gut, and that's kind of where they want to be. And then, of course, what happens, the fish poops, and the bacteria ends up back in the sea, and then it kind of has to go through the cycle again to get back into the fish. Remember this, Rebecca, the next time you're surfing.
Yeah.
And you take in some...
I'm a surfer now, you guys.
Mm-hmm. Time you take in accidentally some seawater, you may well be swallowing Photobacterium.
How do they
poop?
In poop, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there'll be lots of them just in the sea, too.
Will they be... Do they glow throughout this process? So does the poo glow?
It'll not so that we would be able to see it, I don't think. So the amazing thing about these glowing bacteria is a lot of them only glow when they reach a certain cell density. So it kind of makes perfect sense, because they've got to produce this light using a chemical reaction, and it requires a lot of energy. So there's no point glowing if there aren't enough of them to be seen. So what they normally do is they glow in what we call going up to stationary phase, when there's kind of loads of them around. And actually the discovery of how bacteria turn on their light was how scientists discovered that bacteria can communicate with each other. So they all produce a signal, and they measure how much of the signal is around, and that is used to turn on a whole load of genes. This bacteria, it was glowing bacteria from a squid that led to that discovery. But then scientists realized that those chemicals were used by other bacteria to turn on other things. So things like to figure out that you're in someone's lungs and now's the time to cause disease. Those are the same kind of chemicals they use to communicate. Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool. So it's called quorum sensing. It just means being able to sense enough of themselves.
The trays that you had, that you used for the photographs, how long does a tray glow? I mean, is that going to go indefinite or...
No, so they'll probably go for 2 or 3 days.
Okay.
Then they all kind of run out of juice and they all die and turn their lights off.
But did you feed them?
No, so they were growing on agar, so jelly, and that had kind of all the stuff they needed. But once they've all sort of grown and they've done their thing, then they sort of start to die off.
So by dying, they stop fluorescing, as opposed to they stop fluorescing and then die?
So I'm going to stop you there.
Oh, sorry, not fluorescing. Kiwi fruit. What? Sorry.
So it's
Maori. Maori. Not New York. Maori.
Moldy.
Hubits.
So what's the right word?
Hubits. Sorry.
So it's bioluminescence, which is a different thing from fluorescence. So fluorescence is when you have these amazing chemicals that just by their structure, they glow, and they have to be hit by wavelength of a certain light of a certain wavelength, and that kind of excites them, or their electrons sort of pop out of orbit, and when they come back into orbit, they produce light. Bioluminescence is a chemical reaction that produces light. So kind of different things. So my bacteria don't require exciting. We don't have to hit them with light to make them glow.
Unlike Jay's hotel room, which requires a black light to see where it glows.
Can you make lasers from that kind of process? I mean, you got a population inversion, right? And then when they come down, the light is emitted, and that's how a laser works.
Well, so that would be fluorescence. So that the
excitation. But you were describing fluorescence.
So what I work with is bioluminescence, which doesn't require excitation. And so one of the things that's really useful about that is that you don't have to do anything to them. You don't have to hit them with light of a certain wavelength. And so for my research, that's really kind of useful.
So how is it produced, and where is the light actually coming from if it's not?
So it's a chemical reaction. So they put these two chemicals, luciferin and luciferase, together, and in the presence of oxygen and energy that comes from the bacteria, you get light as a byproduct.
So that's for the entire lifespan? Sorry, the whole lifespan?
No, only when they turn these genes on. So they turn on the genes to produce luciferase and luciferin, and then when those chemicals are present, get all the light if there's oxygen around and energy. Right. And then once they don't need them anymore, they stop producing the products of those genes, and then you don't get light.
And then they die, or they
and then they die. Okay. Well, so they'll be in kind of suspended animation. Mm. I mean, essentially. Okay. And if I took, you can leave these things kind of around. They might not be glowing, but if I took a little bit of it and put it on a fresh petri dish, it would glow up again and grow again. Okay. So,
how do they survive the stomach acids? Are they extremophiles?
Actually, I have no idea. I have no idea about the stomach acids of fish. I don't know what they do.
I mean, some bacteria survive stomach acids. They
I don't know about
these ones. They produce proteins that are resistant to the pH of the stomach,
like E. coli.
And right? Like E. coli, anything that you can get that can infect you from eating it has to survive stomach acid. Right?
Does that by definition make him an extremophile?
No,
we don't call them.
It's a pretty harsh environment.
No, it's not enough to doesn't count as an extremophile.
So are glow sticks considered bioluminescence?
No. So it's a completely different kind of chemical.
But it is
reaction.
Just two chemicals.
It is a chemical reaction.
Yeah. So that's sort of, chemiluminescence is what you would call that.
Cool. Do that's all animals bio. That glow use luciferin and luciferase, some version of it, like the glowworms?
For bioluminescence. Yeah, so the New Zealand glowworms, it hasn't been discovered yet what their luciferin and luciferases are, and there's certainly a team down in Dunedin who've been working on it for a few years now. But they haven't quite.
So we're not sure yet.
No.
That's what I was about to bring up. Like that, Susie's the reason why we went to the glowworm caves,
And I'm obsessed.
The 4 years ago, the first time I visited New Zealand, she took me through. And just like in the middle of the tour, she tells me this fact, like, we don't really know why they glow, basically.
We know why they glow. We just don't know. We don't know the chemicals.
Yeah. Right. The chemicals. Like, and it seems like such a, like, it's just this tiny thing, and like there's so many people studying it, and to not know that to me is just amazing and wonderful.
What is the difficulty?
It's not wonderful not knowing.
It is wonderful. That's one of the best parts about being a human is not knowing.
Okay, but how many options can there be? I mean,
so the way that the people in Dunedin were trying to figure this out was essentially we know what the sequences of the genes for things like fireflies and stuff. So they're beetles. And so they were sort of looking for, sort of trying this quite dirty method to try and pull out genes that looked sort of similar using a sort of sequencing method. And as far as I'm aware, that didn't really get very far. So, I mean, really what they need to do is kind of sequence the genome of a glowworm. The other thing they were trying was a more protein approach. So they were sort of taking glowworms. I think I'm probably going to get this all wrong and Miriam's going to shout at me, but they, I think were basically trying to see what proteins were there. And then if any of them made light, and then they would sort of try, if you had any like collections of proteins that made light, then they could try and sort of find out what they were. They weren't coming up with much then either. So they've tried the genetic approach, and clearly it's not the same gene sequence that a firefly uses. So it's something else, but it might just be because they're out by a few bases and some weren't able to PCR. Sorry, that's like so much jargon in those sentences.
No, that's awesome.
I'm really sorry.
Yeah. for the work that you do, what is the imagined like tech that will come out of this? down the road? Like, what is the...
Isn't that every scientist's worst nightmare question? How can we turn this into a weapon later?
No, I mean, how can I make, like, you know, my drums glow? That's what I'm interested in.
Where's my glowing kitten?
So I guess the... I am fascinated by the creatures that glow, but that is not... I don't research them. So what I do is I take these genes and I put them into really nasty bacteria, because what I'm interested in is how they cause disease and how we can stop them. So how we can find new antibiotics and stuff.
Oh, so this is for following them.
Yeah. So I'm just kind of fascinated by the creatures, because it's kind of good to know, you know, your material. But frankly, all I'm interested in are their genes. And then I take those genes and I put them into stuff like TB, food poisoning, E. coli. I'm kind of like a jack of all trades. So if you give me a bug that's kind of vaguely interesting, I'll try and make it glow in the dark. And so, and the reason that there's a number of reasons why this is really useful. So the, one of the first things about light is it requires energy. So only living cells will glow. So it means that we can use light to find really quickly whether our bacteria are dead or alive. So instead of having to grow them on petri dishes, like, which for the ones we were working with yesterday, you know, your pictures will have grown by today, right? So I got these guys to draw in glowing bacteria yesterday. So they will have grown up overnight. But something like TB, that takes 4 to 6 weeks to grow on a petri dish. So that just the time that takes when we're trying to find out whether it's dead or alive, well, you know, you could wait 2 months, or you could just make them glow in the dark like we've done, and then you put something with it, some chemical, and if they're dead, you just put the in a machine that measures light, and then it says light, no light. So you kind of get an answer within minutes, really, rather than 2 months.
So you're trying to cure disease, but my glowing guitar idea.
Right.
I think that would be really cool.
Wait. First it was a glowing drum set.
Hey, I can choose. Guitar. Why don't I have to pick just one? Come on. Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, so the fact that it has to be alive means, you know, we could probably cover it in goo and maybe plate it.
It'll be the first
out.
Oh, but enough about what Jay did.
But it would be cool if they could give you like a tattoo that just emitted light that could feed off of the energy in your body. That would be really cool. I wouldn't do it, but somebody would do it.
I mean, you
cool.
can get fluorescent tattoos already. So yeah. ones that are, so again, ones that you need a black light or something.
No,
to
no, but no black light. You just, yeah. it just.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw a guy had a fluorescent tattoo in the shape of bone. So when you shine the light on his hand, it just looked like just bones. It was really cool.
And it was invisible in normal light. That's pretty bad.
Usually it just looks like a bit of white on your arm.
What about the fish in the deep ocean? Do they use, what kind of bioluminescence do they use, do we know?
So they use bacteria. So things like the anglerfish, they have a colony of glowing bacteria. But again, nobody's ever been able to actually isolate and grow it. So we know that it's bacteria, and they've been able to, they basically know it's bacteria, but the conditions that an anglerfish has for that bacteria to live in its little lure, scientists haven't been able to reproduce those conditions in a lab, so we don't actually know how to grow it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so loads of creatures in the sea that glow actually use bacteria to do that. And often they have this sort of symbiotic relationship where they're producing a home and some nutrients, and in return the bacteria glows. And what often happens in these relationships is if the bacteria don't glow, then they won't be able to survive there. Mm-hmm. The creature will get rid of them because they don't kind of want this dead weight that isn't pulling its weight, I guess.
Has any human culture used bacteria, bioluminescent bacteria, to make lanterns or something? Because, you know.
So the problem, well, certainly not from bacteria. I mean, I guess people would have put fireflies in jars and stuff, right? But they probably last very long.
We used to smear them on our shoelaces. Does that count?
Shrek did that. We did
it with fairies. My brothers used to do that. I used to cry.
But the number of people that contact me, actually kind of designers and stuff who are like, yeah, we want to make some glowing furniture. And, you know, we could do that with the bacteria, but frankly, it would only be glowing for a couple of days and then it would stop.
Keep it going,
so, so actually one of my things for next year is I want to try and figure out if there's a way that we can culture these things in continuous culture to keep them glowing. Mm-hmm. But we might have to salt them in some way because we need them to keep glowing.
Right.
So one of the things that's thought that, for example, this Hawaiian bobtail squid does is it produces an environment that produces lots of – they use the luciferase to kind of get rid of oxygen and other things. So we'd have to kind of hit them with something that they have to glow to get rid of. So, yeah, that's going to be my pet project for next year, I think, if we can figure that out. And then, hey, maybe we could make some glowing furniture. That'd be kind of cool.
You mentioned you transfer genes. What vector do you use? Is it virus, like a virus, to get the genes in there?
So it depends on the bacteria. So TB, we use, we've exploited a way that viruses get into TB. Mm-hmm. Other ones, what have we done? We've done, so for some of the E. coli's, we use the way that bacteria have sex with each other. So they kind of, they exchange some of their DNA. So we kind of use those plasmids. So it all depends on the organism. Whatever we can get our hands on, actually. Whatever is nature's provided. Mm-hmm. And I must say, I've been doing this a long time, and maybe 15, 20 years ago when I was doing my PhD, and people were like, oh man, you know, genetic engineering is really evil. And all I could come up with, it's like really easy. And nature does it all the time. And all we're doing is just exploiting nature's things. It's like, so that's wrong. Should be.
Yeah, bacteria are trading plasmids all over the place. Yeah, that's nothing.
Just making them produce what we want them to produce.
Right, exactly. Yeah, people say that as they inject their insulin, which is based on bacteria that had insulin genes.
Botox.
And,
yeah.
Right. Okay, that was awesomely fascinating. We're going to shift gears a little bit and talk about the Dunning-Kruger effect. Anybody here hear of Dunning-Kruger effect?
I know everything there is to know about that.
Yeah.
How do you spell it?
Don't know.
So, two psychologists, Dunning and Kruger. They did an interesting study, which has kind of become a very popular idea. They essentially took a subjects and they asked them to self-assess their knowledge on the subject. They gave them a test and said, how do you think you did on the test? And then they scored how they actually did on the test. And what was interesting is that people in the top 20, like the top quartile, the top like 20, 25 or so percent, slightly underestimated their performance. They thought they did a little bit worse than they actually did. At around 78%, people were pretty much right on this spot. Below that, people increasingly overestimated their knowledge and their performance on the test compared to how they did. Nobody ranked themselves less than 50%. Percentile. So everyone's above average, right? So everyone thinks they're above average. And even like the bottom 10% of performers thought they were like in the 60th, the 55th percentile, which is interesting. At the time, you know, Dunning and Kruger explained this as this is like a test of competency, and that if you're incompetent, you essentially don't have the ability to evaluate your own incompetence, which everyone thinks, yeah, I know somebody like that. But
so can you interpret that as like, if you're stupid, you can't know that you're stupid?
That's how everyone interprets it, but that's really not a good way to interpret it.
And
this is why we're talking about it again. Dunning, one of the psychologists, wrote a good article about this, you know, a couple of months ago, which I then blogged about, but we haven't spoken on the show yet. But it's a really good follow-up. So there's a couple of points. First of all, the meme that sort of got out there in social media was, dumb people are too dumb to realize how dumb they are. You know, and that's fun to say. But that's not really what Dunning-Kruger is saying.
And that's not new. You know, that's an idea that's been around for a long time. So it's kind of funny that, like, science was suddenly proving Shakespeare right.
Yeah, exactly.
Fool thinks he's wise, but the wise man knows himself to be a fool. Like,
right.
It seems to play perfectly.
That is the Dunning-Kruger effect, yeah. So what's interesting, though, is that everyone is on the curve, right? And everyone is on the curve in different places for different areas of knowledge. So it's not something that applies to other people. It's something that applies to us. It applies to everyone. Also, the question is, why do people so grossly, in the bottom, you know, three quarters, why do they so grossly overestimate their own knowledge? Jay, why do you think people so overestimate their own knowledge?
I mean, I could come up with a lot of reasons why I think we're that's inside of us. Like, why do we naturally do that? I mean, part of it is, I would assume, like, confidence has something to do with performance. So if we really thought and believed that we were wholly incompetent or stupid, that we would maybe not do as much or try as much as we do.
I mean, that's kind of like a motivational
reason. It's like a blocker,
right?
You don't want to just sit there and go, I'm so stupid, I can't do anything, and not, like, lack motivation.
Right.
It's kind of like people
confirmation
that play video
bias?
Games.
So, yeah. Bob, you're getting close with confirmation bias. Again, that's why the people are too dumb to know how dumb they are. It doesn't really fit what they found. It's not that they lack information. It's that they're filled with misinformation. For example, if you talk to somebody who is a global warming denier, they may overestimate their own knowledge of the issue. It's not that they lack knowledge, it's that they have confident misinformation.
Is that Fox News is telling them they're right?
Yeah. Well, that's, in that particular case, it's because there are motivated outlets that something that I've in the past called sophisticated nonsense. You know, it's like if creationists are like we may talk about this at some point, but the video, anybody here see the video of Megan Fox, who is a creationist who was going through the Chicago
not
Natural
that
History
Megan
Museum?
Fox.
Not that one.
Not the dumb one. Actress.
Yeah.
She's an idiot.
So.
She is.
Just a random cheap shot at Megan Fox. Why not?
A cheap shot. She's,
So she's walking through the museum, not the pretty Megan Fox, but the creation for
pretty dumb.
And
random cheap shot at the other Megan Fox.
You heard the thing she said. We're not talking about that right now, but this woman is just.
Are we getting
right.
confused?
Yes. Not the actress.
The non-actress creationist Megan Fox who was going through the museum. Is like ripping apart the displays in evolution and saying, how could scientists believe this? They're so stupid. She's way, way at the lower end of the Dunning-Kruger curve. But she's filled with misinformation. She's filled with ideas that are wrong. And it's not random. And she didn't think of these herself. There's a system, a culture of misinformation about evolution that's out there. And people get exposed to it, they get taught it, and they get filled with this false confidence that they know what the hell they're talking about. Meanwhile, she was spouting unending nonsense, demonstrable falsehoods. And we encounter this all the time, right? How many topics can we come up that where, you said global warming? In my opinion, GM, genetic modification, creationism are definitely probably the big three. I've, gotten into long arguments with people about psychiatry. They don't know anything. They're just completely filled with misinformation. So it was very interesting to read, Dunning write about that. This is now, whatever it is, 15 years or so after the Dunning-Kruger effect was published. He lamenting how misinterpreted it has been in the popular culture. But really, there's a very important core skeptical lesson there. We are all, first of all, subject to it. We all have to, again, at the same time, you could be at completely different places on that curve on different topics. And the thing to really be wary of is not the absence of information. It's being filled with misinformation, especially misinformation that has been systematically biased in one ideological direction. And that's where motivated reasoning comes in, which is sort of a form of confirmation bias. Although it's more of an active process, whereas I see confirmation bias as being more passive. It just sort of happens as a default unless you're working against it. Motivated reasoning is you're actively engaging in reasoning that is promoting a specific belief system that you have.
But isn't there also the idea that you think you have all the information necessary to make a decision? It's like the more you know, the less you know. Mm-hmm. When you start studying a subject or you start jumping into a subject, you realize, wow, there is so much more here than I thought. And the more you learn, the more you realize, by the time you have your PhD, you know nothing. It's like, you graduate high school, you know everything. You go to college, you know a lot. You get your PhD, you realize you know nothing. And I think on that scale, people tend to not realize how much information is lacking. Mm-hmm. And they're making judgments on how much they understand the subject by only analyzing 2% of the information that's actually there. It's like, someone that's going to tell you guys, oh, yeah, you just podcast. Yeah, you get together, you record a podcast, and that's, it's great. Probably takes you an hour and 20 minutes, right? Yeah, great. How hard could it be? They have no idea the complexities involved in trying to produce
it. It takes
an hour and a half. Yeah, yeah. Six, right.
Steve, do people that lack knowledge, though, fit in to this paradigm? Because I can give you some examples of people I talk to. They happen to be people I work with that have remarkably a very small amount of information about a topic. Like vaccinations is the big thing. Like every year when the flu vaccine comes, everyone at my job can get it for free. And I'm literally one of those people that walks around and I'm trying to entice people to go get their flu vaccination. And every once in a while, someone will poke their head out and want to know why I give a shit. And then I'll, do my 1-2 on it real quick. And I'm curious to know what they know. What if they're not getting it, why?
Yeah.
Because it's a good thing to learn because I can, the next time I talk to them, maybe I'll have an answer. And a lot of times, they don't have a goddamn thing in their head.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't, vaccines. It's like, well, what? What about vaccines? there's nothing there.
Yeah, no, it's this.
Yeah, but there's nothing there.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so where are they on this?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I do think it's a combination of underestimating, as George says, underestimating how much knowledge there is. Also, in some cases, being filled with misinformation. What I often do, because, you know, obviously I teach medical students, I teach other physicians, I teach people at pretty much every level of education. It's really fascinating to know. And I like know when I'm talking to a first year medical student versus a second year medical student versus a third year medical student. They're so different. But what I often ask them to do is, like, especially like when you get to a fellow, for example. So now that's like the highest level of specialized training. So this is somebody who has now completed 7 years of medical training. They've done 4 years of medical school, a year of internship, and 3 years of residency. That's eight. I'm sorry, 8 years of training. And then they do a year of fellowship, and then they really learn, you know, what's going on in their narrow area of specialty. And I usually like to, like, halfway through the year or towards the end of the year say, so compare your knowledge of neuromuscular disease after 9 months of studying neuromuscular disease to what you had at the end of your neurology residency after, you know, basically 8 years of medical training. You knew nothing, right? I mean, by comparison, you look back and like, wow, yeah, you thought you knew neuromuscular disease, but now you realize you really didn't. Now, what I want you to imagine, though, is that you are still at that level of ignorance for everything else. Mm-hmm. And it does that for, I don't know why that doesn't naturally occur to people. Or I will, in a lay audience, I'll say, think of something you're an expert in. Everyone has something that they, whatever, a hobby, their job, whatever. How much do other people know about your area of expertise? When you see a news report on the news, you know, about your something that you know a lot about, they always get it wrong, like profoundly wrong. And you're annoyed at how wrong they get it. But just remember that you're that person. You're as ignorant about everything else as you think everyone else is about your area of expertise.
Thanks for
and it's almost like a light going on. Yeah,
but we, the podcast, the process of doing this podcast is humbling to all of us.
Yeah.
And the reasoning is that we'll talk about an item. So we research our items, and we know how to research, and we're very good at vetting the data and doing the process of assembling a list of information that we want to give when we do a news report, right? And it happens quite often. We'll get an email from an expert. Like, this is the person that, like, is, you know, literally invented the information or discovered the information.
This happens to be the topic of my PhD thesis.
And
literally.
They're like Steve as the doctor talking to us, which, I, you know, it's a poor comparison, but we get it, but we don't get it all the way. And then they humble us because they're like, now, let me tell you what the f-ing real story is.
But, Jay, the thing, I think you're mischaracterizing that a bit. That does happen sometimes, but I think generally, though, what we get is, not that you guys screwed up and here's what really happened. What they really do is give us, you guys pretty much got it right, but consider this. And he goes through the details
deeper.
He takes a deeper dive than we could in the time that we have.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it really interesting to me. Because if you think you know something, yeah, we got it right. We weren't wrong. But there's other layers that make it just so complicated and rich that we might have been lost on us.
And then sometimes another person will write in and the two experts are arguing in two perfectly legitimate and different areas. And then we're like, oh my God! Yeah. But that's cool too. So the whole thing is humbling for us.
It's interesting. So we get every kind of response. Yeah. We get the, all right, you guys made a little mistake here, or, yeah, you sort of got it, but you sort of had the wrong spin on it. I've gotten emails from scientists who like, yeah, but the researcher who did the study that you talked about, he's an asshole. And like, they know the guy personally, and like, there's just no way we're going to get at that level of insight into the culture of the scientists who are doing the research. And of course, you know, why don't we always contact them? Well, first of all, we do as often as we can. You know, we have people on tap that we go to make sure, hey, am I getting this right? I'll email the author of the studies to get them on the show or to just say, hey, am I getting this right here? Can you like just give me a bullet? They don't always get back to us in time or at all. So it's hard. It's really hard to do it in a news cycle kind of way. Right. And so then we count on the crowdsourcing after the words where, all right, if anybody did this as their PhD thesis, they'll email us. And then if we need to, we'll come back for the second bite. And often though, most of the time though, it's what Bob said. That's like the 90% response we get. It's like, you guys were good as far as you went, but I love your show, and now this is my opportunity to tell you about the one thing I know more than you guys do. And they give us more information, and it's great. I love it. It's an education for us. And if we don't have to make an editorial decision about whether or not it's worth coming back and saying, hey, here's some another layer of information about the site, which we do sometimes as well.
Yeah, and just to get it back to the original Dunning-Kruger thing.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, that's what we were talking about. I was just thinking of how to best sum up what you're saying. And what I'm thinking is a lot of people mistakenly believe they understand a lot about the Dunning-Kruger effect.
Right.
But are misled by their desire to believe that other people are stupider than them.
No, I think that's true. And I think that's a general skeptical lesson.
It's like a fractal.
So, and this is a theme I think we've been hitting a lot recently on the show in a lot of venues, is that you got to apply all these skeptical tools to yourself. And when you just apply them to other people, you're missing the point and you're probably getting it wrong.
And you're probably a jerk.
You know what's interesting while we're on this? A interesting side note. We get emails from people, and a few weird things happen. One is, like this happens quite often, actually. Someone will say, you got this wrong. Steve will re-listen to the segment of the podcast they're talking about just to make sure that you know you have it in your head. Then he'll comment, and he'll be like, actually, no, that's not, we didn't say that, what you said we said. We said this, and you're wrong, and here's why, and thank you for emailing. And then the guy writes back and goes, well, I didn't really listen to the whole news item.
They email us halfway through.
Yeah. That's the best part.
Those are the best part.
And then we'll get like a second email like, never mind.
Segment. Like, there's so trigger
happy. I see you addressed this 10 minutes later. What are you doing? Go out for a walk while you listen to the podcast, or just sit there with your email program open.
Yeah, but sometimes they do listen to the whole thing, and their memory of it. I like it because you could tell the bias they're bringing to that specific topic.
They hear what they want to hear.
They hear what they want to hear, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're all that idiots, happens sometimes. Basically.
Yeah. All right. Jay, totally different item. You're going to tell us about a whale fossil that was discovered right here in New Zealand.
A whale of
a
fossil.
Yes, I looked for New Zealand news items.
Actually.
I'm not going to go too deep in on this. You guys probably heard about this. And if I'm mispronouncing, you must help me because I'm horrible at
whale.
That.
Whale.
Oh, is it? Oh,
whale.
It actually makes like an F sound.
Whale. I love that. Otago Department of Geology PhD student Robert Bosenecker.
Robert.
Bosenecker and his supervisor, Professor Juan Fordyce. Like, everybody's goddamn name. Like, where are the John Smiths in the world? So Professor Juan Fordyce identified and named a new genus of ancient baleen.
Baleen?
Yes.
Baleen.
Genus.
You know what that means?
Genus. Baleen.
Filters.
There are two types of whales. One's with teeth, and then one's with...
They have like brooms.
The broom handle. So they bring in the water.
This is what they look like.
With the krill or whatever they eat. And then they squirt out the water.
Juan Fordyce, they identified and named the new genus.
Genus.
Two word starts, George.
A baleen whale.
A baleen whale they now call Toharata. Very cool name.
Toharata.
Why does that remind me of something from Star Trek?
I don't know.
What was that skin?
Because everything reminds you of something from Star Trek.
The Toharata, which is Maori for dawn whale, or can be interpreted.
That's a cool name, dawn whale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is cool.
Wasn't she Marianne?
What?
Wasn't she Marianne on Gilligan's Island?
I don't know.
Dawn Wells?
Is it
Dawn Whale? Sorry.
Appreciated by three of us. That's all that matters.
So yeah, like you said, the whale belongs to the toothless filter feeding family, and no chance I can pronounce Iomysticidae.
Right.
Iomysticidae.
Yes.
Sure.
Iomysticidae.
Eon. That's close enough.
All right, I'm staying. I'm feeling good tonight, man. It's very interesting that this is the first time members of this family have been identified in the Southern Hemisphere, so that's the key point to this news item. The whale lived between 25 and 26 million years ago, and it vaguely resembled a mink whale, but it's more slender and serpent-like, which is actually kind of creepy.
Did it have legs?
No legs. The whole animal could have been about 8 meters long. And they were preserved in a rock formation near Duntroon in North Otago. Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. The whole evolution of whales thing is awesome because 50 years ago, the creationists said, you got whales. There's no connecting fossils between land mammals and whales. They're a kind unto themselves. There are no transitional fossils. And then in the 1980s and since, I think first in Pakistan and India, we started digging up these whale fossils, you know, fossilized whale ancestors. And basically, we fleshed out the entire evolution of the whale in the last 30 years. With
Tiktaalik, was that his name?
No. Tiktaalik's a fish. Ambulocetus. Ambulocetus is like the in the middle. It's the walking whale. It is the whale with frickin' legs.
Awesome.
It is the quintessential transitional fossil. It completely blew away the creationist argument. And you know what they say?
We're about the one in between that one.
They say, nope, those bats. They don't have any connection between bats and other mammals. They just shift it over to another example.
Move the goalpost.
Yeah. They completely ignore the fact that the Ambulocetus totally blew them away.
Yeah.
And, you know, someday we'll find some half bat mammal things and then they'll just shift over to something else. Unbelievable.
So why are we doing science then?
Because we don't care about them.
It is frustrating, but the fact is we get to relish in awesome news items like this and they just miss it all.
Yeah, I love whale evolution.
Hip bones, awesome. Right?
They have leg bones.
They have leg and hip bones still in modern whales.
Modern whales have little vestigial hip bones. Yeah.
Susie, how about a badass glowing whale? Yeah. Like a beacon of modern science.
I will do my best.
Get on it.
All right, get on it.
And I'll ride that fucker.
Yay! That's like a rocket.
That's a good point, though. Susie, we don't see any large glowing things.
So apparently in New Zealand we have a giant glowing earthworm.
How big is giant?
I have no idea, but I'm told they're big.
Husband is saying...
Yeah.
That's how he got her to go on the first date.
Six inches.
Yeah. He's a mathematician, so I don't really trust him.
Is that the biggest glowing thing in the world?
It's the second
biggest. There are some quite big beetles.
Beetles. Oh. Look at me, I'm glowing. I don't know why. It's great. Yeah. I'm excited. I'm just happy to be glowing.
Now, does that thing move around and does it interact with people and hurt them?
What I did learn just recently, though, is that from quite a famous entomologist in New Zealand, that he thinks that this one actually has a glowing bacteria inside of it. That's the reason... The reports from the American Civil War that soldiers who had glowing wounds were more likely to survive their injuries.
Wow.
I have never heard of that.
So this is an awesome... Sorry, am I allowed to do this? There's an awesome glowing bacteria. It's one of the only bacteria on land that we know glows, called Photorhabdus luminescens. And it normally lives inside... The most well-known symbiosis of this one is it lives inside a microscopic worm. And this worm burrows its way into larvae of various insects. And then it produces a whole heap of toxins, which kind of kill this poor little caterpillar, which then starts to liquefy, and that's kind of awesome nutrients. And so the bacteria and the nematode all reproduce. And for some bizarre reason, the bacteria also starts to glow. And it's thought that maybe this attracts more silly larvae to the... You know, and then they're basically the worms and the bacteria reassociate, and then they kind of spill out this carcass looking for their next victim.
Cool.
And so he reckons we've actually got this bacteria in New Zealand, and that's the reason those ones glow. And so he was like, give me, you know, here's my card. We'll go and find some. I'm like, yes. We're going to go and find ourselves some giant earthworms.
And
then we'll identify the bacteria.
I've never heard this idea before. So in the American Civil War...
Yeah, so apparently there's some documentation. So the really important parts of that story that I completely missed out is that, so now we've got this kind of liquefied larvae that's this bag of nutrients that everything's growing in. And so what Photorhabdus does is it produces antibiotics to stop other bacteria from taking advantage of the soup.
Yeah.
And so what was likely happening, so these soldiers who survived, they had glowing wounds, and they used to call it angel's glow. But what's much more likely is those soldiers had got Photorhabdus, which lives in the soil, on their wounds. It was producing antibiotics, and that stopped other nastier bacteria from taking hold and killing those soldiers.
We have to travel here to hear this?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. You have just blown my mind. I've never heard of this.
I can't believe that
did that fuck you up?
No, was that
Disney? Yeah.
That fucked me up.
Next extravaganza. That's your fact.
So can people see the wounds glowing?
Yeah. I mean, it only happens under very certain circumstances. I think about this, it's to do with the temperature of people's bodies and blah, blah, blah. But, yeah, there are apparently documents that it would help people.
That's awesome.
That is really cool.
It's just in.
Rebecca.
Yes.
How come that when I go to YouTube and I watch a video, interesting stuff happens that you're going to tell me about?
Good segue. Yeah. Good intro.
I don't want to steal your thunder. Just go.
Yeah. Yeah, so I found a really cool study in the journal Social Science Computer Review, which I'm sure we all subscribe to, or which someone on my Twitter feed subscribes to and mentioned.
I read that for the articles.
I read it for the sexy pictures of computers. So, yeah, there was a paper titled Down the White Rabbit Hole, the Extreme Right and Online Recommender Systems, which was produced by researchers at University College Dublin. And they were looking into the idea that people might get caught up in a sort of feedback loop when they're on YouTube. So we've talked on the show before about how people online can end up seeking out information sources that already stick to what they already know, you know. So if you are left-wing, you know, you're going to be looking at left-wing sources, and you sort of self-select your information. And that makes it difficult to reach out to people who are maybe, you know, if you're a skeptic and you're trying to reach out to somebody who's a vaccine denier, it can be difficult because vaccine deniers are looking at other vaccine denial websites and things like that. They're self-selecting this stuff. But what this research was looking at was not how people self-select, but how the platforms they use might funnel them into the same sort of bubble that they would otherwise be choosing for themselves. So, you know, and this is interesting because a lot of these platforms like Twitter and Facebook and YouTube claim to be politically neutral, you know, by design, by necessity. If they were not neutral in as many ways as possible, you know, obviously they would come under fire. So what they say is, so long as what you're saying is legal, you know, go ahead and say it. We're not going to censor people just because they have opinions that we don't agree with, you know, which is fair enough. However, these sites use certain algorithms to direct their users in certain ways. So this particular study looked at YouTube. YouTube, when you watch a video, off on the right-hand side, you'll see recommended videos. Mm-hmm. And there's an algorithm that decides what videos YouTube will be showing to you in order to get you to click through and continue watching YouTube videos. And obviously the algorithm is focused on finding things that each user will enjoy in some way. But what these researchers were looking at is what exactly are they showing you. So they looked at extreme right videos. Extreme right being things like very racist or nationalistic, KKK, neo-Nazi sort of stuff. Some music as well, like, you know, nationalistic metal and things like that. And what they found was that, by and large, basically they took all of this data from YouTube and they looked at which videos were being the most recommended. The most recommended being the number one most clicked link on any one YouTube page. And what they found was that with extreme right videos, that top video, more often than not, tended to also be extreme right. Not just being within the spectrum of something that user might find interesting, but always specifically extreme right. And the top-rated video was much more likely to be extreme right than any of the other related videos. And what the researchers point out is that this can lead people to getting trapped in an ideological bubble, which can be particularly bad when you're talking about hate groups, because the whole purpose of many people who are uploading videos that are extreme right is to, in some way, encourage people to go out and to do something to, you know, activate this base of racists and misogynists and things like that. And when you get caught up in that ideological bubble, it's much more likely that you will be able to activate that kind of base. So the researchers come to this conclusion that even though we see these platforms as neutral, and we tend to think of people just choosing their content on their own, the platforms and the algorithms they use actually do end up pushing people in one particular direction. And so they suggest that maybe tweaks to these algorithms could prevent people from becoming more extremist in their beliefs. It could help expose people to differing beliefs in some ways if the platforms are open to making those changes.
Yeah, I hate the idea that the content I'm being fed through Google or whatever is being tweaked based upon what the algorithm thinks I'm interested in.
Yeah.
I hate that.
Yeah.
I hate when I do Google searches and oh, great, my own blogs are coming up. That's
right.
Awesome. It's like, no, they're just feeding me my own shit, you know?
And no matter what, you know, there's always going to be an algorithm.
Yeah.
You know? And so, unfortunately, there's no opting out of it. There's no way of saying, like, I want an algorithm that's not going to influence me.
Yeah.
Like, it's not going to happen, you know? No matter what, you know, it's going to have an effect on users.
Yeah. And it's social engineering when you think about it.
It is, yeah.
Either way, you do it. I do think, I don't know, I just still think they should try to be as neutral as possible.
You know? And they are.
Well, but,
you know,
but
they're not...
They not suggest anything.
This is a complicated thing, though, guys.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they're not... Nobody is spinning... No plates behind the scenes, like trying to cause this effect. I mean,
no,
seriously, Google,
an unintended
in particular,
consequence.
Yeah, they are trying to produce hits, things
make
that
money.
You want to see. Have you ever used somebody else's Google account
mm-hmm.
as an example? You could do this. You know, you could sign into your Google. I'm a huge Google user and fan and everything, but it learns you. You know what I mean? It knows.
Sure.
It knows a lot of stuff about you.
Have you noticed? We're in New Zealand.
Right.
We're searching on Google here. We're getting New Zealand news items.
Yeah.
We're getting
yeah.
fed, you guys, what you would normally see. It's different than what I would get fed if I was doing the same searches
sure.
in the U.S.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, there are ways that you could make Google not know who you are. But the point being, though, is ultimately, maybe not in this particular circumstance, and like if they want to actually, like you were saying, social engineer something more constructive in the search results. My circumstance, I'm looking up like Star Wars trailers and just show me everything. You know, I'm cool with that. That, you know, I'm not going to turn into an asshole from that.
Really?
But did anybody see the George Lucas version of the new Star Wars trailers? Just go watch it. You're going to love it. But the point being, what's that?
The Lego version's better.
I haven't seen that one yet.
Oh.
I'll check it out tonight.
Lego. I hate Lego.
The cool thing about Google, though, is it really does do us a lot. There's a lot of work behind the scenes in order to produce that information, and as fast as it is, and we should be thankful for it because it really is something. It's a miracle that they're able to do what they're doing. It is. It's fantastic. The technology is just extraordinary.
All praise Google.
So when we say
it's like you want to find a brand of Kit Kat bar, let's say,
yeah.
And you really want a peanut butter version of a Kit Kat.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, and you find it. You find it, and you buy it. You've bought the thing you want, and now every ad that comes up is for a peanut butter Kit Kat.
Right, yeah, you've already bought it, though.
But you've bought it already.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing that's the most, like,
yeah.
every
yeah.
piece of gear that I look for the next 6 months now, it'll say, hey, you want a crash symbol?
Yeah.
You want a crash symbol?
The thing is, Google doesn't know that you purchased it.
Of course.
Yeah,
and Google's
that's
algorithm
right.
is saying...
You
this
search
person
for it.
Has searched
search
for this.
For,
oh, they probably haven't bought it yet.
I get it, but I want it to phosphor. I want it to bioluminesce and be able to provide me.
And that's
it.
The thing. Like, I think in a way, you know, we're at this early stage of developing these algorithms. So, you know, when I'm on YouTube, I actually get served a ton of recommended videos that are just the worst possible thing for me, and they actually tend to be extremist content. Like, you know, if I like watching like Anita Sarkeesian videos, who's a feminist game critic, I'll get a bunch of videos in the sidebar that are like, you may also like Anita Sarkeesian is, you know, a Jew, like, whore, you know, and it's like, whoa, what? No.
It's like the Google ads on our site. Would you like this homeopathic remedy?
Right.
I just wrote an article trashing homeopathy. They haven't triggered that.
So I
figured that out.
I would love to see a similar study like this, but looking at less extreme viewpoints, like a skeptical viewpoint, for instance, or a feminist, or, you know, something like that, and how that pans out. Because I get the feeling that because the algorithm is in a way so basic, it's going to latch on to those black or white sort of options. So when you do watch extreme right videos, it's like, oh good, I know exactly what you want, you know, and bam, like I've got you.
It should allow you to opt out of it.
Yeah,
yeah. That's what I was going to say.
User like StumbleUpon lets you thumbs up or thumbs down content, and it changes its algorithm.
What happens if you clear your browser, clear your cache, clear all that stuff? Does all that go away?
No, you have to delete your Google account.
You have to delete the Google account.
You have to not be signed in.
These solutions don't actually solve the problem that the researchers have identified, you know, which they're not looking at people who would opt out of these things. Mm-hmm. You know, they're looking at people who would see that next extreme right video and say, oh, okay, well, that supports the thing I just saw, so this is, and it gives a false sense of majority and helps activate people, helps give them a feeling of community with a very extreme, you know, hate movement type of ideologies.
It's a bit scary, because increasingly the internet is our one source of all information, and it's complicated managing that massive amount of information. And essentially, computers are deciding how we access information based upon algorithms that are not serving our own interests or even desires. It's kind of serving whatever, some click algorithm.
Right.
And just wonder how far that's going to go. You know, we're all going to be living in our own internet bubbles, you know, that are just crafted to us. That's why I do like the opting option. At least if it's right there, do you want a Google search that remembers your history? Do you want one that's totally neutral? Do you want news that's skewed towards New Zealand? Do you want it skewed internationally? Do you just want the most popular of everything that's happening out there? You know what I mean? And then I'd like to compare them.
That'd be one hell of an app for someone to write. Like, I want to see Google as it appears in 50 countries of my choosing.
Yeah.
You know? See, and that would be really cool. But again, you know, that's for somebody who's already primed with the idea of, oh, it's a benefit to me to seek out opinions that are different from my own.
Like seek out new lives and new civilizations.
Yeah, you do boldly go blah, blah, blah.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready for this week?
No.
Bring it.
Yes.
You can do it.
Susie, you ready? All right.
Susie.
Here are the three items. Again, one of these is fake. All right, number one. A recent study found that in 5 adult ICUs in one hospital, there were over 2.5 million patient alarms in 1 month. Item number two. A new prospective study finds that those with a commute greater than 31 miles one way have an increased life expectancy compared to those who live closer to work. And item number three, scientists have discovered the oldest carving by a human ancestor, 500,000 years old, and the first by Homo erectus. So we're going to start by polling the audience. George, will you do your single clap thing?
Sure.
Okay. So if you think that 2.5 million patient alarms a month is the fiction, clap once.
It's late.
Yep. If you think that having a long commute to work increases your life expectancy, clap once. And if you think that scientists discovered a 500,000-year-old carving by a Homo erectus, clap once. If that's the fiction, clap once.
Sorry.
All right, well, so that looked like two, then one, and then nobody believes three. Okay. Or thinks this is the fiction. So let's go down. We'll start with our guests on the right.
Let's go first. Okay, I read something about the carving. 500,000 feels really old, though. And I think that's the trick. I think the trick is that I think Steve knows we all read. We saw the little potato with the carvings on it. And we're all going to go, oh, that's real. Half a million seems too much. I'm saying that's the fiction. I'm saying that's the fiction.
Okay.
I'm saying that's the fiction.
Susie?
Oh, I'm going to be really dull and go with the... So that you have a better life expectancy if you...
Commute to work.
Long commute. 31 miles or more than 30
no, they come with you. I'm going to go with George.
You think that the 500,000, that's the fiction?
Yeah.
Okay. Evan?
How many ICUs in the 2.5?
Five. It's basically one hospital, which has five adult ICUs. There were over 2.5 million patient alarms in 1 month.
That seems high, too. Jesus.
No, those things go a full time.
Yeah, I have no idea what a patient alarm is.
Million.
You mean like when somebody stops breathing and goes like, boop, 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 boop. Okay.
An alarm going off when it happened 2.5 million, greater than 2.5 million times.
That's a really high number, 2.5 million of these things going. Five ICUs, got a number of patients.
Can I use a calculator to calculate how many times per second that went off?
That's too high.
Is that allowed?
That's too high, Steve.
Not allowed?
Patient alarms has got to be the fiction. I think of the three of these, that's the most extreme number here. So that's the fiction.
Patient alarms. Okay, yep. Bob.
Can you skip me?
Nope.
No. Homo erectus, huh? First one, half a million.
Seems high, right? I mean,
it does, but 2.5 million, that's like...
No, that seems high, too.
A lot.
Jeez. And that's in five patient bays in one
hospital. 1 month, five adult ICUs. Hospitals have multiple ICUs.
Okay, so just multiple beds.
All the adult ICUs in one hospital. Over the course of 1 month, there were greater than 2.5 million patient
That's
alarms
insane.
Went off.
All right, half a million is too big. That's
okay,
fiction.
Rebecca?
I was going to go with the commute thing because I feel like commuting more than 30 miles would significantly decrease my life expectancy. And, you know, like, traffic accidents happen a lot. But then I was thinking, most accidents occur within, like, a mile of home. And then I was thinking, most rich people can afford to live in fancy suburbs and commute into the city and back out. And they would probably have higher life expectancies anyway. And people of a lower economic class.
You're overthinking.
Would live, okay. The Homo erectus thing.
Yay.
See, so the one that you said that if you live 31 miles or farther away from work, you have an increased life expectancy.
Yes.
So we're saying that the more time you spend in the car equates somehow to a higher life expectancy. It's
That's
very
right.
interesting. At that one alone, I could turn around a million times in my head. I mean, I'm thinking, like, and I've done long and short commutes, and I'm much happier with a short commute, and I think happiness is important. All right, I'll take that one as the fake. I think that's wrong.
Okay, so we're spread out. So
should we re-poll the audience?
Yeah, we'll re-poll the audience. So this is to see how much of an influence our expert panel had on you. So if you think 2.5 million patient alarms in 1 month is the fiction, clap. If you think longer commutes make you live longer, clap. If you think that 500,000-year-old carving by Homo erectus is a fiction, clap.
We totally got
Tripled.
Some people. Yeah,
Tripled
that was a dramatic effect. You guys flipped them from 2 to 1, from the life expectancy to the ICU alarms. Okay, so let's see. Do I go with the panel or the audience? Let's. I will default to taking them in order since we're kind of all over the place. A recent study found that in five adult ICUs in one hospital, there were over 2.5 million patient alarms in 1 month. I think, Evan, were you the only one on the panel who thought that one was the fiction? The audience was convinced by that. A lot of them thought that one was the fiction. And that one is
science.
Yeah, baby.
How is that possible?
Yes, that's a lot of freaking alarms.
It's the finger all the time.
Yeah, that's hundreds of patients every day, every few moments. There's an alarm going off, and it adds up to over 2.5 million alarms.
There's always an alarm. You ever go to the hospital, there's always a bell ringing.
Yeah. So this was this.
There it is.
The study was specifically done to look at something called alarm fatigue.
Yeah.
Which is kind of self-explanatory.
Huh? So you ignore the alarm?
Exactly. Yeah. So what happens, there's alarms going off all the time, you just ignore them. They all the same study
that's
also
an alarm just under one alarm per second for a month.
Yeah, but there's one.
Yeah, but there's Bob, but there's hundreds of patients. Yeah.
I'm just saying it's an average. Okay. It's an average. Come on.
Yeah, I know it's a lot. It's crazy. 88.8% of them were false alarms.
What does that mean?
They
a lot of them.
So that
no, does it mean a thing? Fell? No, hold on. Things like there's the springs in those things are shut. They fall off your finger in like 2 seconds.
But it's not just the oxygen sensor on your finger. It, a lot of the so they broke out specific kinds of alarms. EKGs, right? Okay. So 88.8% of them, when I say a false alarm, that means that nothing had to be done. So either it was just an error, or it was not actionable, or it was a false positive. It was picking up, like it thought it was an arrhythmia, but it really wasn't an arrhythmia.
Or they got there so late they were already dead and didn't have to do anything.
So clearly we need to take steps to reduce the number of alarms that are going off, raise that threshold, because when it's like crying wolf, right? This is the ultimate, the boy who cried wolf. There's alarms going off all the time. It's part of the background. I work in hospitals. It's part of the background. It's like just unless it's going off right next to you.
But you kind of hope in an ICU, like they didn't ignore them.
Yeah, well, they don't, but it also contributes to them constantly.
I don't care unit.
having to run in, to the patient room. And by definition, in ICU, you have one to one nursing anyway, so the nurses are kind of in the one nurse to one patient in the room.
Why are nurses so angry?
Yeah, because they're answering alarms all
the time. The damn thing won't stop buzzing, Jay. That's why.
Now, what about the NICU with the babies?
Yeah.
So
it's probably the same thing, but they didn't study them. They only studied
They didn't study.
Let's go on number two.
Tim Taft.
A new prospective study finds that those with a commute greater than 31 miles one way have an increased life expectancy compared to those who live closer to work. Jay, you thought this one was fiction. You're the only one on the panel.
There's quite a few people in the audience that agreed with
me. A few people in the audience thought this one was fiction. They switched after Evan convinced them to go to the wrong one. and this one is the fiction.
Yes.
Very well done.
Jay Bird.
Nice, Jay.
Who clapped? Stand up.
Yeah. Well done.
Ah, there you go. Thank you. Nice, okay. Nice.
So, the study actually showed, as Jay also said, that people who have a longer commute have a lower quality of life. They are not as happy. And this wasn't the recent study, but I had to look it up. There are studies which show that people who have a longer commute actually have a shorter life expectancy.
Nailed it.
Shorter life expectancy. Not sure why.
It's here for
a I'll tell you why. Rebecca's like, zero commute. I'm going to live forever.
But the hypothesis is...
There you go. I got to get on that.
I live forever while watching Netflix in my underpants.
Watch that damn YouTube video.
Yeah, YouTube.
It's goddamn right with
suggestive videos on the right.
The hypothesis is that it causes stress. That people, when they have a longer commute, they have less time, and they feel time pressure, and that causes stress, and the stress kills them.
Obviously, yeah.
Yeah, of course. So let's go to number three. Scientists have discovered the oldest carving by a human ancestor, 500,000 years old, and the first by Homo erectus, and that is science. Isn't that cool?
I remembered reading that. Yeah. That number was...
It was a shell.
Yeah,
and there's markings in the shell that are geometric, and it had to be deliberately carved. Like it was hard to do it. Yeah. They reproduced it on both fossilized and fresh shells, and it's not the kind of thing that can happen by accident. Somebody had to like really scratch it out deliberately, and it's in kind of a pattern. They're still debating over whether or not you would consider this art, whether or not it counts as art. But that's kind of irrelevant.
But to be fair, they're still debating that over a statue of a penis somewhere in the Tate Modern.
Yeah, right. But it clearly was a deliberate carving, and it was by a Homo erectus, which we have carvings by, obviously, Homo sapiens. Like, we talked about this, I think, the other time you were on the show.
Yeah.
A Cro-Magnon man, in that case. We've also have paintings done by Neanderthals. But this is the first one by a Homo erectus. Homo erectus is an older... hominid. They emerged around 2 to 2.5 million years ago. They went extinct about 140,000 years ago. They are almost certainly the ancestors of both Neanderthals and Homo sapiens and modern humans. They were the first hominids probably to use fire. And also the combination of hunting and using fire enabled them to essentially spread throughout the world. So they were the first ones to like really range far and wide. The Australopithecines were largely confined to Africa, for example.
Can we talk more about the commute, though?
No.
Nope.
Do you have any other insights you want to
Can we talk more about bed?
I got it right, though.
Yeah, you did, Jay. You got it right.
Good job,
well done.
Jay.
Solo victory.
It's very exciting
Feels
to
good.
Do this at a live show.
Feels good.
Yeah. From a very intelligent live audience.
Yeah.
It happens.
The Homo erectus, though, is very surprising.
It is pretty cool.
Yeah, I like that one. Jay, do you have a quote for us?
I have a quote.
Do you need my version? You good?
This is a quote from Ernest Rutherford.
A Kiwi.
You guys know who he is?
The Rutherford Atom.
Do you take ownership of this man?
Oh, yeah. He owes you money.
Then you must take ownership. He owes you money?
No.
Is that awesome?
That bastard.
Hey, Ernie, let's go today. Come on. The VIG is 6%, son of a bitch.
Can we say that's actually how Jay was like, I should find a New Zealand person. I was like, just look at the money
and
pick a random dude.
Scientists are not dependent on the ideas of a single man, but on the combined wisdom of thousands of men, all thinking the same problem, and each doing his little bit to add to the great structure of knowledge, which is gradually being erected. Ernest Rutherford!
We'll give him a pass on the whole man.
Yeah.
Thank you all for joining me for this episode. Thank you to the wonderful audience we had with us tonight. George, always a pleasure to have you on the show.
So nice to be here again. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this whole trip. It's been wonderful.
Unreal. I'm going to miss you guys. Yeah, I can't even begin to think about it.
You have to come visit. Like, we live right next door to your sister.
Yeah, totally. That's true. Come see the funk band.
Funk band, we definitely. Yeah.
January 10th.
January 10th.
There you go, January 10th.
Susie, wonderful having you on
the
show
again.
Thank you
so
much for having me. Awesome. Thank you for visiting.
We learned a lot tonight.
Yeah. You need to make more globing stuff.
Okay, yeah. I'll do that.
Awesome. Guys, as always,
thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.